Please take a seat. Let me add my welcome to Andrew. It's great to see you here. And please take a Bible, if you closed it, and turn back to 1 Kings chapter 21. And we're going to pick up the story from the cliffhanger. So just to recap what we've just heard read, Ahab is the king of Israel. He's got a nice palace and a nice garden, but he'd like to extend his garden. And in particular, he'd like to build a vegetable patch. And the absolutely ideal place for this vegetable patch is a vineyard owned by a guy called Naboth. So he says, well, sell me your vineyard because I quite like it as a vegetable garden. And Naboth says, no, I'd rather not sell it to you because it's my inheritance to pass on to my children. And Ahab is very, very upset. And then Jezebel, the king's wife, has a plan. She says, let's get him on a false charge of blasphemy. Let's stone him to death, and then we can have the vineyard. And the plan goes absolutely as intended. And the witnesses make up this rumor about him having cursed God. And so people take him outside and stone him to death. And the vineyard is then available. And Ahab gets his vegetable patch. And they all lived happily ever after. No, not quite. Because the story continues. Verse 17. Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, arise, go down to meet Ahab, king of Israel, who's in Samaria. Behold, he is in the vineyard of Naboth, where he's gone to take possession. And you shall say to him, thus says the Lord, have you killed and also taken possession? And you shall say to him, thus says the Lord, in the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, dogs will lick up your own blood. Ahab said to Elijah, have you found me, O my enemy? He answered, I have found you, because you have sold yourself to do what is evil in the sight of the Lord. Behold, I will bring disaster upon you. I will utterly burn you up. I will cut off from Ahab every male, bond or free, in Israel. I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and also like the house of Baasha, the son of Ahijah, for the anger to which you have provoked me, and because you have made Israel to sin. And of Jezebel, the Lord also said, the dog shall eat Jezebel within the walls of Jezreel. Anyone belonging to Ahab who dies in the city, the dog shall eat. And any one of his who dies in the open country, the birds of the heavens shall eat. There was no one who sold himself to do what is evil in the sight of the Lord like Ahab, whom Jezebel, his wife, incited. He acted very abominably in going after idols, as the Amorites had done, whom the Lord cast out before the people of Israel. And when Ahab heard those words, he tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his flesh and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went about dejectedly. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, have you seen how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he's humbled himself before me, I will not bring the disaster in his days. But in his son's days, I will bring the disaster upon his house. Well, here is a story of a king. We've been following this royal family all the way from, well, in Grace Church for more than a year, but in 1 Kings all the way since chapter 16. And they are an evil family. We're told that they win the Guinness Book of Records for being the most evil. No one has done more evil in the sight of the Lord than Ahab. No one has made God more angry than Ahab. And we're almost at the end of his life. He's going to die next week. Sorry for the spoiler. But do come back to see him meet his grisly and well-deserved end. But this is the last in his catalogue of sins. And as we read the story, it's pretty obvious what's going on. It's a story of the abuse of power, of the ways and means available to the most rich and powerful. If you or I would quite like to extend our back garden, well, you can ask the neighbor, can I buy it off you? And if they say no, that's where your options run out, right? But if you are sufficiently powerful and you've got connections, then there's other ways of getting things done. And Ahab is absolutely unscrupulous, and he gets things done in a most underhanded and horrid way. So Ahab is the villain, and his wife Jezebel. Naboth is the victim. And the question is, where do we fit into this? So it's a story from a long, long time ago with a goodie and a baddie. And what's it got to say to us? Well, I want us to make one point about Ahab, one point about God, and one point about Jesus. And you'll see on the inside of the service sheet, we're going to look at those three characters in turn. King Ahab, and God, and then King Jesus. King Ahab, he's a case study in evil. He is a case study in what it means to break the 10th commandment. I don't know if you know the 10 commandments, if I were to test you now. Lots of Anglican churches used to have the 10 commandments printed up on the back, on the wall. And obviously we're hiring this lecture theatre, although it probably did the University of Greenwich well. Good to have the 10 commandments painted up there. But if you need to revise them, then they are in Exodus chapter 20. I'm going to read you the whole list. Here they come. God says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. So they've just been rescued from being slaves to Pharaoh. God rescued them in an amazing way with a mighty hand and outstretched arm. He parted the waters of the Red Sea so they could cross on dry land. And finally, they come to Mount Sinai to worship God. And God says, since you are my special people that I've rescued, this is what you need to know about living my way. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything in the heaven above or the earth beneath or the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. See a little hint of that in the way that God is not just angry with Ahab, but his whole house, Ahab and all his descendants, are going to face the consequences of what he's done. Verse 7, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Commandment number 4, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your livestock, the sojourner who's within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that's in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. And then they get quicker. Number 5, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. Number 6, you shall not murder. Number 7, you shall not commit adultery. Number 8, you shall not steal. Number 9, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Number 10, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Are those the rules that God gave to his people? Not because God was a sort of a grumpy headmaster who wanted to make life really boring, but because God's a loving God. He wanted his people to love him and love each other. That's how Jesus summarized the Ten Commandments. Love God with everything that you have and love your neighbor as yourself. And so if you want to love your neighbor, don't steal their stuff. Don't kill them. Don't sleep with their wife behind their back. Don't lie in court about them. And don't covet. It's the only one of the Ten Commandments that's something that you do with your mind. Explicitly, it's a mental sin. Coveting means wanting something that someone else has. And God says, don't do that. Don't murder people. Don't steal stuff. Don't want stuff that other people have. In other words, God is saying that he cares not just about our outward behavior, but even about our thoughts. And if we're to love each other, we oughtn't have an eye on things that other people have. Well, here's a great example of that, how badly it can go wrong. Because this guy Naboth has a vineyard and Ahab really wants it. I mean, it's a stupid thing, isn't it? It's a trivial thing. It's not like Ahab really needs everything. He's a very, very rich king. It's just that, you know, well, his garden sort of ends over there and just across the wall is this vineyard, and that would just be great for growing some cucumbers and tomatoes. And well, he goes with money first. You know, I can get you a better vineyard. You know, I've got lots of money. I don't mind buying a vineyard somewhere else, but give me that one. And Naboth says, no, sorry, I'm not up for that because it's my inheritance from my family. I want to pass it on through the ages because the Lord's given it to us. And Ahab wants this vineyard so much, he can't get it out of his head. And it gets to the point that he just goes to bed and won't eat anything and just lies in an absolute sulk. He is obsessed with this vineyard. I mean, it is a ridiculous story. It's almost like a child in this story. I must have it. I want that vineyard. Why are you not eating anything? I want that vineyard. And so Q, Mrs. Ahab, the queen known as Jezebel, and she thinks, oh, my husband's an absolute damp blanket. I'll sort it out. So she takes matters into her own hand. Verse 8, writes letters in his name. So I guess she steals some of the royal headed note paper with the seal of the palace on it. And she writes this plan. And she says, this will sort it out. Let's get Naboth killed. What does Ahab do wrong? He covets. He wants something that doesn't belong to him. And he wants it and wants it and wants it and wants it. He can't sleep because of wanting it. And in the end, it causes a great evil. Often the way in the Bible that the commandments that seem the smallest ones have a domino effect to the ones that are the biggest ones. And I don't know if you count. The reason I read the whole of the Ten Commandments is that maybe you can see the quite a lot of different commandments that get broken in the chain, like a chain of dominoes. It starts with coveting, wanting his stuff. Anyone want to add any others they spotted being broken? Say again. False witness, yeah. So they get two people to lie about Naboth, saying, oh, we heard him cursing God, so he ought to die for blasphemy. It's totally untrue. So they make up a false testimony. Stealing, yeah. It's kind of like stealing, isn't it? He wants it, I suppose it is stealing. Kill him and then grab his stuff, yeah. That counts as stealing, yeah. And then murder, in the end, murder. Now, we think of murder as really bad, and we think of coveting as what's the problem with it? It's just something you do in your head. I just rather like your bag. Oh, I wouldn't mind that bag, Tim, and I'd rather like it to be my bag. And what's the harm? I mean, if I murdered Tim now in church, you'd be quite shocked, wouldn't you? But if I'm just secretly in my head thinking I'd like his bag, what's the problem? But God thinks it is a problem. If we're to love each other, what we do in our heads, what we think about each other's stuff, that's the beginning of it going wrong. And it's a whole domino effect. Number one, he breaks the 10th commandment. Number two, this is a subtle point. I don't know if I'll persuade you of it, but he wants to unrescue Israel. Remember, the 10 commandments begin with, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. He brings them into a land flowing with milk and honey, the promised land to be their inheritance. And God's land and God's people are characterized as being a vineyard. So he actually calls Israel God's vineyard. It's sort of the emblem, what it means to be the fruitful people of God. It's a great symbol. If you've ever been on holiday to somewhere where they can successfully grow vines and just pluck the grapes and just snack on them, what a fantastic image. But the image of Egypt in the Bible is of a vegetable garden. Vegetable gardens are only mentioned twice in the Bible. One is to say you left the land where you sat round vegetable gardens and you come into the land where you become a vineyard. I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but I think it is maybe significant that here is a king who wants to kind of turn back the clock. He wants to go back to the ways of the land before. Well, there's another hint of that in verse 26. He acted very abominably in going after idols as the Amorites had done, whom the Lord cast out before the people of Israel. He wants to go back to before they became Christian, before they became rescued, before they became God's people, back to Egypt. The king who unrescues, the king who wants to destroy all the things that changed in their lives when they became Christian and roll them back to what it was like before for his own ends. So he breaks the 10th commandment, he unrescues Israel. And then this is where Jezebel steps in. And there's a problem in that to start with, because Ahab does nothing about it. He is just very passive. He was quite passive in chapter 20 last week. because he refused to bring justice. And he's quite passive in chapter 21 because he refuses to stand up to his wife. We're told, verse 25, there was no one who sold himself to do what was evil in the sight of the Lord, like Ahab, brackets, whom Jezebel, his wife, incited. In some ways, it was her who did it. I mean, she arranged the murder, and yet he is held responsible because he is so passive that he just stands by and let anything go up but go on his watch. But what she does is really, really very horrible. She uses as a weapon against Naboth, so that she can get this vineyard, she uses religion. And that really is a horrid thing, isn't it? A horrid twist. When you're prepared to actually use the Ten Commandments and the law to break the Ten Commandments and the law. She goes, oh yeah, religion, that will be handy. I mean, not to do the right thing, but to do the wrong thing. And there's this blasphemy law, and if we get people to say that they saw him curse God, then he'll be stoned to death, and that'll be great because then the vineyard will be available and then we can get the vegetable garden that we wanted. Now, what's the point of this little study in King Ahab? I want to say, don't be like him. You know, don't covet. I mustn't covet other people's stuff. And don't bear false witness, and don't murder people, and don't be him. Don't unrescue Christians. Don't let your wife steal your headed notepaper and arrange a murder. I mean, you know, don't do that. But I don't think that is really the point of this chapter. Because few of us are in that sort of position to be able to exercise this kind of tyranny. Of course we shouldn't be like him, but the point is, he is a king. And if you're a king, if you're in charge, if you're powerful, then you can abuse people quite easily. All it takes to coordinate this entire murder is headed notepaper from the palace. Actually, I was telling James and Kate Squire, I was going to preach on this yesterday, and James said, oh, it sounds very like the story of David and Bathsheba. It's very, very like that, isn't it? Send a letter, arrange a murder, job done, problem solved, dispatched. If you're powerful, you can get this kind of thing done. And we do live in a world where we may not be Ahabs, but where it's quite possible that we might be Naboths. There are certainly many Naboths in the Christian church, and victims of tyranny. Somebody richer and more powerful than them who wanted something that they had, who had the power to squeeze it out of them. Even who had the power to use the church to squeeze it out of them. Isn't that one of the most embarrassing things about our history? If you're a Christian, I'm talking to a friend who's not a Christian, and they start bringing up all the things that have been done in the name of religion. The Crusades, the embezzlement of huge amounts of money and land by the national church. I always remember, this shows my age, but the old Robin Hood film, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and it turns out that the ultimate baddie is the priest. I think it's quite a popular theme, isn't it, in the modern day film. But what an awful taste it leaves in the mouth when religion is right at the centre of the rot. And that's what's happening here. She uses God's law to bump off her political enemy to get the vegetable garden. And they all lived happily ever after. But they didn't. Did you notice that the whole story kind of finishes before verse 17? And then it's like a little extra, like a little appendix. And in verse 17, everything changes. Because even though tyranny of this kind, even though abuse of power of this kind happens all over the world, all throughout history, the big change comes when we realize that God knows about it. It's exactly the same in the story of David and Bathsheba, actually. You get the whole chapter, the whole story, all done and dusted. And the last verse of the chapter says, but the thing was evil in the sight of the Lord. I think the way it's written like this is brilliant, because from verse 1 to 16, you could read it as a non-Christian. This could be a non-Christian story. It's got religion in it, but non-Christians believe in religion. It's just a sort of powerful social force. But verse 17 turns it into a Christian story. And I want to challenge you, if you're here as an unbeliever, you haven't got an ending to the story after verse 16. Powerful people exploit vulnerable people and get away with it. Happily ever after. But the twist in the story comes because God speaks, and God's seen everything, and God is very, very unhappy about what's happened. Go and down to meet Ahab, he says, who's in Samaria. Behold, he is in, notice the description, verse 18, he is in his new vegetable garden. No, he is in Naboth's vineyard. So God has got a very clear view of who this bit of land belongs to. And he knows everything that's been going on. Have you killed and taken possession? And thus says the Lord, in the place where dogs licked up the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick up your own blood. He doesn't mean actually in the same place, because Ahab dies somewhere a bit different. He means instead of. So instead of dogs licking up Naboth's blood, they're going to lick up your blood. It's a particularly horrible way to go, isn't it? To go to the dogs. And yet it's a particularly 1 Kings way to go. I've put some cross references there. You'll see it's one of the book's favourite ends for horrible villains. Basically, in 1 Kings, you can tell what God thinks of someone by what happens when they die. If they're good king, they get to sleep with their fathers. You get to be buried in the family tomb. And if you're a bad king, then something really awful happens to your body. And in this case, it goes to the dogs. And the same thing exactly happened to Jeroboam and to Baasha. You see the cross references. Dogs will lick up your blood. It's a story of God's justice. Because even though Ahab might not care about the little guy, God does. And the vulnerable and the exploited. We don't really know much about that, maybe, here at Greenwich. We think, you know, I don't get the relevance of this. But we've just got to think a bit more globally. I mean, there are people today who are being exploited by the powerful. Refugees, trafficked children, persecuted Christians, often without recourse to any higher power, because the person who's the higher power is in on it. But God knows. He cares for the little guy. And he announces judgment on Ahab. And they all live happily ever after. Not quite, because there's another little appendix, and this is just a lovely little conclusion. Verse 27, when evil King Ahab heard these words, he tears his clothes, puts on sackcloth, and went about dejectedly. And God notices and is really pleased. Even though he's a mega evil king, God is really pleased that he repents, that he takes action to say sorry. And God even, it's like God is so excited about it, he wants someone to tell. I love this bit. So verse 28, the word of the Lord came to Elijah saying, have you seen what Ahab has done? You know, when you're just really excited about something, you just want to call someone in and say, look at this. Well, God says that to his prophet, Elijah, look at this. Ahab, I mean, you know, the most evil king, the one who I've put at top place in my Guinness Book of Records spiritually. He's put on sackcloth. He's repenting. And God shows him a little bit of mercy. It's not full-blown mercy. This isn't Jesus mercy. This isn't being rescued from all of your sins through the cross mercy. This is, I'll give him a little bit of mercy. As in, the dogs are still going to lick his blood, and we'll see that next week. So it's just, but it's not going to be quite as bad as it might have been. Because God notices and likes it. Well, what's the application of this? Well, it's good news, isn't it, for the oppressed. And bad news for the oppressor. Many of them in this world nowadays. But there is a God who notices. He sees. He acts. There will be justice in the end for the vulnerable. So the tyranny of Ahab, the justice and the mercy of God, and then finally the glory of King Jesus. I think one of the points of looking at the stories of all of these kings is to compare and contrast with the King of Kings. We were just singing just before this sermon, He is King forever, He is King forever, He is King forevermore. Unfortunately, we weren't talking about Ahab. Can you imagine if he was king forever? That would be very, very bad news. Of course, we're talking about Jesus. But Jesus is just very, very different from Ahab. Number one, he can sympathize with Naboth. This is really remarkable. Let me read you again what happens to Naboth. She wrote, Jezebel wrote in the letters, proclaim a fast, set Naboth at the head of the people, set two worthless men opposite him, and let them bring a charge against him, saying, you've cursed God and the king. Then take him out and stone him to death. Let me read to you from Matthew chapter 26. Those who seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. Peter was following at a distance. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus so they could put him to death. They found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last, two came forward and said, this man said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. And the high priest stood up and said, have you no answer to make? And then they condemn him to be crucified. It's very similar, isn't it? We want to get him. We can't find any reason to get him. But no worries, we'll just sponsor some false witnesses. We just need two. That should be enough according to the law of Moses. Two or three witnesses. Let's get two, save some cash. Get them to come in with a false charge. And on the basis of that, we can kill him. It's very striking, isn't it, the similarity. In other words, Jesus, he faces the tyranny of a corrupt regime. Notice Jesus faces the tyranny of a political regime that harnesses religion to make its case. Just exactly the same as Naboth. He knows what it is to be at the receiving end of this kind of tyranny. Jesus is nothing like King Ahab. He's very like Naboth. And what a comfort that will be to many all over the world who experience that kind of victimhood today. And then, it almost doesn't need saying, does it? I've put on the sheet, he is nothing like Ahab. I mean, it's just kind of obvious. But it made me think how wonderful it is that Jesus isn't a king who's just trying to extend his palace. He's after things that belong to us. Oh, I rather like that jumper. I wish I could get that jumper. Oh, I'm the king. I can probably get that jumper. Oh, the garden of my palace is not quite as big as I'd like. Maybe I could get his vineyard to add to my vegetable farm. I mean, it's just laughable, isn't it? Because, of course, Jesus owns everything in the world. But it made me think he's not a king who wants to grab more of our stuff, but a king who wants to give us his stuff. He's a generous king. Not to mention he's an honest king. He never bears false witness. Not to mention he's a life-giving king. He never murders. And then I thought, that's quite unusual, isn't it? Because it's a cliche that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And Jesus has absolute power. And yet instead of being corrupt, he's generous and true and life-giving and wonderful. If you're not a Christian, the story ends at verse 16. And you can see it all over the world today, injustices. And no real hope of any change. That those who have got more money and more power will always exploit those who have got less. But verse 17, there is a Lord, a God in heaven. There is a judgment day. And there is a better king, a different king, that we know and serve. I'm going to leave a pause, and then we're going to be led in prayer.